You're listening to the podcast, So You Want to Be a Writer, with Valerie Koo and Allison Tate. Valerie is an author, journalist, and national director of the Australian Writers' Centre, which is one of the world's leading providers of online and classroom courses for people who want to get published and write with confidence.
Allison Tate is a freelance writer, blogger, and author of the best-selling series, The Mapmaker Chronicles. She has more than 20 years' professional writing experience.
Each week they explore the world of writing, publishing and blogging to bring you news and opportunities, advice on how to succeed in the world of writing, interviews with top writers and much more. With students enrolling from all over the world, you can find out more about the Australian Writers' Centre at writerscentre.com.au.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 104 of So You Want to Be a Writer. That's 104. I'm Valerie Koo and I'm here with the fabulous Allison Tate. How are you, Al?
Well, apparently I'm fabulous, Valerie, so let's go with that, shall we? I've actually got my hair out today, so I'm feeling a little bit fabulous. I don't usually, normally I'm sitting here and it's in a ponytail, you know, I'm quite serious. But
you would look like a pre-Raphaelite, you know, angel.
I look kind of weird because I've got the headset on and it's but it's quite good because it keeps all the foof out of my face, so I'm pretty happy with it actually.
A pre-Raphaelite angel doing a podcast.
Exactly. I know. Yeah. So we're very, you know, with it, we pre-Raphaelite angels. What can I say? So, yes, how are you today? What are you doing?
I'm well. I'm a little bit exhausted because I had a whirlwind trip to Melbourne yesterday and I was on my feet all day, you know, teaching a seminar, then had to get the plane home and then, you know, all the rest of it. And
oh, that's right, because you told us last week that you were going to be building many, many profiles.
Yes, building.
Building
many.
Brands, building, weren't
that's
you?
That's right.
So all that construction is exhausting.
It is an exhausting process. So, but I had a good night's sleep last night and all is well now.
Good.
Yes. So we just want to give a shout out, though, to Jenny L. Ivins, who left us a lovely review on iTunes. And Jenny has said, I've recommended this to my friends for months. So thank you, Jenny.
Oh, and we love that.
Yeah, we
love
that.
Word of mouth. We love word of mouth.
Absolutely love it. So Jenny says, if you want a weekly dose of fun writing inspiration, tune into Al and Val's informative podcast, So You Want to Be a Writer. Though I doubt they know my name, my fame has yet to reach far circles.
Oh, we do now, though.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do.
Their conversations complement my real-world friendships as they support me by providing the latest writing news and opportunities, along with tips such as the motivational value of banoffee pie. Thank you, ladies. There are so many people who are tweeting me saying, I've just Googled what that is. Oh my God, I have to get some.
See, you're all crazy. I just don't get it at all. Yeah. The whole banoffee pie thing has passed me by entirely.
And if there are any new listeners, basically, you know, everyone has different levels, different incentives that work for them in their writing or in achieving their goals. Mine is banoffee pie.
And Al's is not.
Yes, and Al's is not. But Jenny speaks about the latest writing news and opportunities, so that's what we're going to plunge right into, aren't we, Al?
We are. Let's do that.
Well, the latest writing news, one interesting story that has emerged of late has been, it's a fascinating story and it's told in The Independent and we will put the link in the show notes and it's titled The Girl Who Stole My Book, How Elis O'Hanlon Found Out Her Crime Novels Were Swiped by a Stranger. Now, Elis O'Hanlon is a crime novelist. And
you realise that she's Irish, so her name is probably Eilish or
oops,
something like that, because it's a, you know,
yes,
how, yes, she's going to be like that poor, you know, oops, actress who has to wear how to pronounce my name written
oh,
on her t-shirt.
Saoirse.
So do you think, yes, that's right. So it could be Eilish for all we know.
Yes, sorry about that. So I'll just call her O'Hanlon.
Yes, let's call her O'Hanlon.
O'Hanlon is a crime novelist and has been for many years. And she just happened to be cruising Twitter one day and she clicked on a tweet by someone else who made reference to another author who was tweeting another author saying, oh, are you sure you're not Ms. O'Hanlon, and it basically led her down a rabbit hole, down that rabbit hole, she basically discovered that this author, who you know had several books online on Kindle on Amazon, had essentially taken not just the plot, but almost scene by scene, she had copied her books, but just changed names and changed...
And tense.
You know, scenes.
It, and point of view, because it was written in... Hers was first person and it was changed to third person or something along those lines, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
which is a lot of work.
Oh, yeah, you know.
Anywho.
It's such a shock. So she basically discovered that... someone had been ripping off all of her work, but, you know, hoping that they would get away with it by changing key, you know, just character names and settings and time periods and, you know, that sort of thing. And eventually she tracked down the author, the person in question, who supposedly fell on their sword and said, oh, you know, I'm so sorry, and pulled it off Amazon. But who knows for how long this has been going on. And Amazon had subsequently pulled all of the books after Ms. O'Hanlon brought it to their attention. And communication then ceased from the author in question, right? So, yeah, a little bit.
Well, I thought it was a very interesting story because it wasn't just one book, it was a series.
Yes.
The productive output of this particular author was ridiculous, like they were writing 13 books a year. But, you know, Nora Roberts does that, so we can't be too judgmental. But at the end of the day, you know, I think it's one of those situations where as a writer, as an author, your heart just sinks because this kind of stuff is so easy to do. Everybody's throwing a book up on Amazon every 5 minutes. I thought the measured response from Miss O'Hanlon was excellent because I think I would have probably screamed and shouted
nuts.
And been completely outraged and shouted on Twitter and done all those things you probably not meant to do. But I just think it's a really I found it a fascinating story. It's quite a long read, but I think it's worth reading all the way to the end and having a little think about it. And also thinking about, I mean, the other thing I found fascinating was that when the books were pulled off Amazon, you know, readers of that particular fake author were complaining because, of course, a new book had just been released and they were desperate to read it and stuff like that. And it wasn't until people started telling them in the comments on Amazon what had been going on that they even knew. I mean, because, of course, readers don't know. They don't know where they're coming from. Unless you've read both of those authors, you're not going to know that you're reading the same book that's been ripped off someone else.
The fake author, who supposedly is called Joanne Clancy, she ripped off books that were about 10 years old. So I guess she was doing it in the hopes that people hadn't read any of these books recently. And at one point, the book in question, which is called Teardrop, was the 111th most downloaded book or most popular book on Amazon. So it earned a little bit of decent cash.
Well, that's right. And I think the other interesting thing about it from Miss O'Hanlon's perspective was that she and her partner who had written the books together, the books had been published, had gone out of print, and they'd been talking for ages about the fact that they really should get them made into ebooks because the rights are reverted. They really should do this and get them up there. And, of course, I think seeing what has happened, they've subsequently actually got themselves organised and have are in the process of uploading that series to Amazon, which of course is somewhat ironic in the sense that, you know, I guess, I don't know. Like it is the kind of thing as an author that just makes you want to cry because you think,
absolutely,
you know, you put so much work into these things and with the, you know, digitalization of books, it's so much easier to do that these days than it ever used to be. And it costs next to nothing to do from the perspective of the fake author.
And when she contacted fake author Joanne Clancy, you know, she replied saying that she was ashamed of what she'd done and that she hadn't been able to think straight for months and that she'd read the book in question and been inspired. And she also claimed that she had only received a few hundred euros to date, but Amazon eventually confirmed that the book had earned a little short of 15,000 euros. Fairly decent amount of money, which was a book that was only on sale for a few months. Sorry?
Buyer and author beware.
Yeah, that's right. Buyer and author beware. Let's move on to something else. And I thought I'd put in an interesting link. This is from a post called 10 Common Online Copywriting Mistakes because, you know, we haven't talked about copywriting for a little while. And we'll put this link in the show notes. But they talk about 10 common online copywriting mistakes. And I think that these are spot on. Number one is bad headlines. I think that sometimes people, when they're writing online, they think that they need to be funny, or they need a headline that is funny, that maybe is a pun or something quirky, but really you just need to be clear. And you need to entice people to click without being clickbait. The other thing that I see a lot online in terms of copywriting is when people put no subheadings. Now, online, having no subheadings is a big sin, because people need scannable content, and people don't read online in the same way as they do typically, you know, a printed version of the same thing. So you need to include subheadings to just break up some of the grey text for the reader, and for the reader to be able to get that breathing space as well. Another thing is not putting the best bits first. Again, because of the attention spans these days, sometimes people think, oh, I've got a cracker of a joke or a cracker of a story, and they actually think they want to use it as the punchline. But in fact, some people don't get that far, and they're never going to see the best bit. So sometimes online, anyway, you should put the best bit first.
I disagree a little bit with the opening line of this, because they say the way people consume online content is different to how they would read a newspaper or novel. Now, as someone who trained in writing newspaper articles, we were always taught that you put the who, what, when, where, why in the first paragraph, because some people never get further than the first paragraph in a newspaper either. So I think that's actually quite old school. It's an old school way of writing. It's not a feature article style of writing.
Yes.
It's more your very classic news article kind of writing. And I think, you know, it's a great piece of advice for online, but it's also, it's got its roots in, you know, and it also used to be, I remember, because you used to have to write that way, because basically when they used to lay newspapers out, they used to do it and they would actually literally so it was done out in hard copy. And the subs, if the story didn't fit the space that had been allocated, they would simply cut from the bottom. So you had to make sure that all the important bits of your story were in those first couple of paragraphs, because they didn't even, you know, when they were actually laying it out, it was like, oh, it's three paragraphs too long, and they would simply lop off the bottom three paragraphs.
Yeah.
There was no rearranging. It was just gone. So if you wanted the point of your story to be made, you had to make sure it was in the first, you know, the first couple of pars. And it's the same online, because people are going to look at what's on their screen. And sometimes, you know, if you're reading on mobile, sometimes all you're seeing is the first two paragraphs. So, yeah, very important.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on to something else, just a great little list we've got here from the expert editor, called the Top 55 Apps for Writers in 2016. Now, we've mentioned quite a few of these, but what's useful is that these are all in a single list. So my latest favourite one from this list actually is Notability. I'm quite enjoying that at the moment. You do have to pay for it, like it's $6 or something like that. But what I find useful with that, you know how if you're an editor in particular, sometimes you like marking things up, as in not with, you know, track changes in Word, but with your actual red pen.
I hate track changes.
I know.
I just need to put that out there. Like, just let me just have a moment of a soapbox here. I hate track changes.
Why do you hate it that much? I mean, I don't like it, but why do you hate it that much?
I despise it. I don't know. Because? I just find it, it's just so, I don't know. I can't even articulate why I hate it so much. I find it complicated, and I find it a pain, and red lines and green lines and, you know, 15 different colours of comments. It's just, let's just get to the point now.
Well, I agree it's not the best, but I don't quite hate it with that much hate. However, sometimes, you know, when you're editing things, you sometimes like doing it with your red pen.
Yes.
But if you're on your tablet or, you know, your iPad, like I am often, and you don't have it printed out, well, you can't do it. So what I love about Notability is that you can mark up a PDF just like you're marking up, you know, with a red pen. So I bought my little stylus from JB Hi-Fi, and I just write on my iPad, and I can draw little circles and say, this is too long, and crush things out, and yeah.
Oh, you would love that. Valerie, with the online equivalent of a red pen.
That's
is
right.
Just a nightmare for everyone. They're all out there. Anyone who's ever taken one of your classes is out there just going, oh, no. I like the sound of Story Tracker. I think that sounds like a good one. Have you ever tried that?
No.
So it's a according to our list here at Expert Editor, it's available from Apple and for $9.99, so it's expensive. Story Tracker will allow you to organise and track your writing submissions to various editors or publications. It allows you to take notes about each submission and save requirements that might change from one publication to the next. I think if, you know, as someone who, like if you've often got a lot of stories out on pitch or whatever, I think it's a great way of keeping track of where things are up to, whether they've been accepted, whether they haven't, you know, blah, 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 get your deadlines in. I think that sounds like it could be quite good.
Yes, and if you don't want to spend $99.99, you can use an Excel spreadsheet for free.
You could, but, you know, those of us who don't like spreadsheets.
Fair enough.
I like spreadsheets about as much as I like track changes, but we won't go there.
Okay, why don't we go somewhere else like
I've got some cheerful news.
You have, yes.
I do have some extreme. Let's end on a happy and cheerful note.
All right.
So excitingly, the Richelle Prize for Emerging Writers, which is presented by Hachette Australia, The Guardian Australia and the Emerging Writers Festival, is now open. And basically it means Matt Richelle was actually the publisher at Hachette Australia when my Mapmaker Chronicles books were first accepted, and I met him, and he was a wonderful man. And unfortunately, he died very suddenly in July 2014, and this prize has been established in his name. And the prize is open to unpublished writers of adult fiction and adult narrative non-fiction. And the winner, here's some good news. You do not need to have a full manuscript at the time of submission.
Great.
Though you must intend to complete one. The winner of the prize will receive $10,000 in prize money, along with a 12-month mentorship with one of Hachette Australia's publishers.
That's
which
fantastic.
Is a fantastic prize. And yes. I seriously think that if you are in the process of developing a manuscript or you've got one there that's ready to submit or whatever, you have absolutely not one thing in the world to lose by submitting it to this prize.
Yeah, wonderful. That's
so we'll put the link in the show notes as to how you can actually enter your how you can submit your publication, your manuscript.
But if you're out walking the dog, it's the Richelle Prize for Emerging Writers, and it's R-I-C-H-E-L-L if you want to Google while you're dog walking. So let's move on then to our giveaway for this week. Our giveaway I actually mentioned last week, and it is Nikki Saver's book, The Road to Ruin, which is how Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin destroyed their own government.
Oh, yes. And there has been so much talk and so many sort of newspaper column inches, you know, devoted to this particular book. So have you read this?
Yes, and it's a number one bestseller.
And is it a good read, Valerie? Is it something you would recommend for us?
It's definitely a compelling read. I would say that if you have an interest in politics, it is a must read. If you don't have a particular interest in politics, which is kind of me, it's still a very, very educational and interesting read. If you have no – and I don't, you know, follow politics very, very closely, but I still, you know, had an enjoyable time. And it's very, very well written. If you don't have a awareness of politics, I would say that if I was the editor of this book and you were, you know, writing it for that audience, there are a few things in there which should have been explained. It made some assumptions as that you would know certain events and people that certainly were in the news and that would be part of your consciousness, not just consciousness, but it would be front and center for you if you were in politics. But there were just a couple of things here and there that I thought, maybe that should have been explained. I knew what they were, but I don't necessarily think that that everyone does. And that is evidenced by the fact that, and this is a true story, Alison.
Okay, I'm ready. Hit me.
I was speaking to a very intelligent woman the other day, very intelligent. In fact, you know who she is. And I was saying, I'm reading this book, you know, the book about Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin. And she said, "Who's he?" And I said, "Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin, you know, Tony Abbott's chief of staff. Who's he?"
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
So, I mean, that's just an example. I know that lots of people aren't necessarily like that, but I'm just saying that some of the little incidents could have been explained a bit more. But that is a minor point to what is a well-written, extremely well-researched book with great insight and very easy to read. Even if you don't know all the players, it was still interesting. there was one little strange. You know how you talk about the saggy middle in fiction?
Yes.
Well, this is not fiction, of course. This is non-fiction. But it's interesting because there was a section that kind of I was like, what is this? It was like this ode to press secretaries. And I looked at it and it was smack bang in the middle of the book. So sometimes that, you know, nonfiction can go a little a bit awry as well. But
well, look, all I can say is if you are the lucky winner of this book, dear podcast listeners, please let us know what you think, because I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on this particular tome, because Valerie clearly has many of them.
And if you have already read the book, do tweet us and let us know what you think as well. Entries close the 18th of April. Just go to writerscentre.com.au/win. And if you're listening to this podcast in the future, don't worry. If you go to that URL, writerscentre.com.au/win, you will find another book that you can win.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our popular course, Creative Writing Stage 1, is the perfect way to unlock your creativity and explore the world of writing. You only need a couple of hours a week, and you'll learn how to create memorable characters, believable dialogue, and captivating plots, all in a supportive environment in this 5-week online course. Whether your goal is to write a bestseller or simply tell better stories, learn at home with your very own tutor giving you personal feedback each week. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/creativewriting.
All right, so let's move on. What's funny, Al?
I'm just laughing. Everything about this podcast makes me smile, Valerie. You know.
Okay. Well, I have a word of the week.
Of course you do.
Yes.
What have you got for us this week, Valerie?
Foment.
Foment. Not ferment.
No, not ferment. Not F-E-R-M-E-N-T, which is foment. Like what you
is
do.
Is this the fear of missing a moment?
No, but that's it's a not. Pretty good.
You like it?
That's a pretty good word. No, F-O-M-E-N-T, foment, which means to instigate or to stir up. So you might foment a riot.
Oh, really?
Yes. Or it means to, you know, to incite or provoke or to agitate. You might foment that person to take action. Foment.
I can see why it's not in wide use, though, because, you know, incite and agitate and are better in
yes.
those particular set of circumstances, aren't they? Foment. Yes. I'm going to go and foment a riot. It just
yes.
doesn't have quite the ring that we
doesn't
require.
Quite. And no. Interestingly, that came from the book The Road to Ruin.
Oh, there you go.
Because, of course, you know, they foment lots of political action.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you for that one, Valerie, to add to my, you know, wide list. Have you been using that one this week? I know you do like to try to throw them into conversation where possible.
I used it on Snapchat this week.
Oh, stop it. You're so cool on Snapchat with your foment.
So let's move on. I believe you have a link for us in the world of blogging.
I do. I have a link to there is a terrific blogger by the name of Stacey Roberts, and she blogs at a blog called The Veggie Mama. So hello, Stacey, if you're listening. Now, I was reading Stacey's blog this week, and she wrote a post that really resonated with me, and I think it will resonate with anybody who has been blogging for a long time as I have. And she was basically talking about the changing nature of blogs and how we sort of started blogging around about the same time, which is around 6 or 7 years ago. And back in the day, because, you know, it is pretty much ancient history when it comes to blogging, when you're talking about 6 or 7 years ago, blogging was quite a different beast. It was a very chatty, sort of informal, it's hard to explain, but it was a different beast to what it is now, because I think as blogs have become more mainstream and monetized and all of those things that they've become, they have also become very, there's a specific expectation of usefulness And often people will talk about, you know, when you're writing a blog post, think about how useful it is, because, you know, people go looking for information and they go looking for different things. And so the nature of blogging has changed a little bit. You don't get so much of the chatty post anymore. And there used to be a lot of chatty posting out there. There was a lot of people talking to each other through their blogs. And she's written this blog post called I Went for a Drive and I Thought About Stuff. And it was all about this idea of, you know, this usefulness and how, because a lot of the time writing, one of the beauties of blogging and something I've always talked about is it's one of the major benefits of it is its ability to help you find your own voice. Because as you just sort of dribble along in your blog, writing things and seeing things, and it allows you to find that intimacy of your own voice. And I think that that's something that blogging has really given me over the years. And Stacey talks about this, and she talks about the fact that she misses the useless post. And it's an interesting thing, because this post that she has written has incited this kind of movement. All of a sudden in the last week, there's been a whole bunch of people who've read this post of Stacey's and are also clearly, and I'm one of them, I wrote a useless post, who have, you know, are missing that sort of just that chatty insight, that intimacy that blogging used to have, and they're writing useless posts. And I think that one of the joys of that is it gives you that real insight into other people's lives and other people's thoughts. And I just wanted to shout out to Stacey to say thanks very much for reminding us all, because some of the best posts on my blog are useless posts. They're the ones that I enjoy the most. They're the ones I like to read back on the most. They're like a little record of that daily life that you don't always get if you're busy being useful. So I just wanted to say, I just wanted to shout out, and I think it's worth reading Stacey's post to get to have a little think about how blogging used to be and how maybe bringing back some of that intimacy might be not a bad thing.
And sometimes those useless posts, in inverted commas, are the most beautifully written.
They are, because people really pour themselves onto the page, you know, and it's about a small moment, or it's about, you know, I wrote a post a couple of weeks ago about, you know, what to blog about when there's nothing to blog about. And one of the ways that I get to a blog post, if I can't think of something to blog about, is I ask myself, you know, three questions, you know, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? And how can I be useful? So those are the three questions I ask myself if I'm looking for, you know, inspiration for a blog post. But sometimes it's those what am I thinking, what am I feeling posts that are actually, I think, my best posts. So I think it's just something to think about. If you do have a blog and you are getting stuck with writer's block, because this is one of the things that Stacey talks about, sometimes trying to be useful all the time just makes it really hard.
Yes.
Sometimes you just need to write. You just need to, you know, download your brain onto the page and see what comes out of it. And so I recommend that, particularly if you are struggling a little bit with writer's block. And if you're trying to find that voice, that writing voice, you don't have to do it on a blog, but have a crack at it on a Word document if necessary. Just, you know, what are you feeling? What are you thinking? Start writing. It's amazing what comes out.
That's a great idea. Yeah, fantastic. All right, we'll put the link in the show notes. So thank you, Stacey, for that post. But let's move on to our writer in residence this week.
Excellent. Let's do that. Who have we got, Val?
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun. Our writer in residence this week is none other than the lovely and amazing and talented and fabulous Pamela Freeman, who also writes under the name of Pamela Hart. So she has 27 books under the name of Pamela Freeman, and she's written, you know, children's stories, picture books, fantasy novels, adult books. But last year she released a historical fiction book under the name of Pamela Hart called The Soldier's Wife, which went very well. And this year, so right now, she has released another book, which is also historical fiction, called The War Bride. And I've read it. It's awesome. It is set in Sydney in 1920. And, let's have a listen to Pamela. Thanks so much for joining us today, Pamela.
It's always a pleasure, Val.
Now, for readers who haven't read The War Bride yet, can you tell us what it's about?
It's about a young woman called Margaret Dalton, who married an Anzac soldier in England, comes out on a war bride ship in January of 1920. And when she gets here, she's told that her husband was already married. So it's a bit of a shock to her.
Yes. Now, I've read the book and I loved every word. But more on that later. How did the idea for this book form? Where did it come from?
It actually came out of the research I did for The Soldier's Wife, the book last year. Mm-hmm. I was reading a book called Bride of an Anzac, which is the story of a war bride. And Queenie Sunderland, who wrote the book when she was 95, died when she was 103, and she was a fantastic character. And it's her memoir, and she told the story of this girl, Margaret, who was on the same war bride ship as she was. Mm-hmm. And when they got to Sydney, they realised that the address her husband had given her was fake.
Mm.
And apparently this happened so often that the army actually ran a hostel for these women.
And so prior to reading that book, were you aware of war bride ships and that sort of thing?
I knew about war bride ships. Mm-hmm. For example, I knew that Tilly Devine, you know, the famous madam, had come out on the same ship, in fact. Mm-hmm. But what I wasn't aware of was how prevalent bigamy was.
Mm.
It was incredibly common. And there was one Australian soldier who married 8 French women.
Good Lord.
Every time he was transferred to a new town, he got married.
Wow. He just wanted to be with someone.
He wanted to avoid the VD in the brothels.
Mm.
And have someone do his washing, I imagine.
Of course, yes.
yeah. And that made it all the way to British Parliament. There was a big inquiry. But bigamy was very, very common, partly because, you know, people were a long way away from home and maybe they'd separated before they left, but divorce was very expensive.
Mm.
And working class people generally didn't get divorced. They just separated and lived with each other, or sometimes went through what was called a form of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
But also just that people got lonely.
Yeah.
And of course, in those days, a lot of girls wouldn't sleep with you unless you married them.
Yes.
So you married them.
Goodness me.
Yeah. And these are our great bronzed Anzacs. We don't hear these stories.
No, we don't. I learned so much from this book. But you've written in other genres, in many other genres. You've written picture books, you've written fantasy, you've written lots of different things. Recently, before The Soldier's Wife, which was your last book, prior to that you wrote The Castings Trilogy and then The Soldier's Wife. What made you – and The Soldier's Wife is historical fiction. What made you move from fantasy to historical fiction?
The Soldier's Wife's based on my grandfather's war record because he was at Gallipoli.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading out to my son's school class the telegrams that the family got when he was wounded, and it was such a terrible litany. And I couldn't help but think, what was it like to get those telegrams? And that's mm-hmm. where The Soldier's Wife came from. I just got overtaken with the need to tell the story. And as I've always liked history, I've written, you know, The Black Dress was another book of mine, which is a historical novel about Mary MacKillop. And I love research. I'm addicted to research. Mm-hmm. And as I wrote The Soldier's Wife, there were so many good stories, you know, and I just couldn't stop writing them. So
so when you read that book about the war bride ships, yep. about that particular Margaret, and it obviously struck you, did you know yes. at that point that's going to be my next novel?
Yes, I did.
Really?
Yeah, at that moment I thought this story is too good not to tell.
Wow. Okay. So this is your billionth book. Well, it's your 29th book. And that's certainly something for a lot of people, that's hard for a lot of people to get their heads around, 29 books, you know.
It's hard for me to get my head around.
You must always be writing. Like in our previous podcast that when we spoke about your writing routine. I'm interested to know if your routine has changed over the years. Like when you were doing, you know, book number 1 or 2 or 3, is your writing routine and process now very different, or is it very similar to now that you're at book 29?
It's quite different.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was writing my first book, I was working as a consultant in organisational communications, and my writing was pretty much a hobby, really,
mm-hmm.
and I fitted it in around my clients' needs. And I did that for several years, quite a few years, and then I got married and had a baby, and then the writing got fitted in around the baby's needs. So it was very good. Was very good preparation, yeah. You know. And then school came. School is wonderful. School gives you a guaranteed writing time. Mm. And that's when I was writing the castings books. And that's probably my most regular period of writing, you know. But recently my parents are elderly. My mum died last year. My dad's 93. And so writing is fitting in not only around being a mother but also around helping my parents. And so every year seems to have a different routine. You know, the only thing that's constant is the need to write.
Wow. So tell us with this book then, what was your routine? Did you have any ritual to start off with, or did you, you know, to get into the zone, or did was it snatched in time because you were busy with, you know, the things that you've got responsibilities with? What was this routine like?
Mostly afternoons. Mm-hmm. Now that my son is in high school, he doesn't need mum to pick him up from school or anything like that anymore. Mm-hmm. So my best time for writing is always between 3 and 7.
Really?
Which, of course, it's the worst time.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to make dinner. And of course, I teach at the Writers' Centre 2 nights a week from 6:30.
Yes.
So that means leaving home about 5:30. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a juggle. And sometimes I write in the evening. After dinner, a lot of it is about, a lot of writing is actually not sitting at the computer, it's the thinking. Mm. And today I drove up to Newcastle for the Newcastle Children's Writers Festival, Children's Literature Festival, sorry. And so I had 4.5 hours in the car, 5 hours in the car, and I was writing in my head the last scene of the new book.
Wow.
And so when I come to write that scene, I may not have all of the words, but I have all the dialogue.
Right.
I know. And I have a really clear picture of, or it's not really a picture, it's a feeling. I have the feeling that I need to get across in that scene.
Mm.
Now, I haven't written the rest of the book yet.
Oh, okay.
But I have the beginning, the very beginning. And I for this particular book, I really needed to know how it ended.
Right.
Before I wrote it.
The thing I'm most scared of in doing something, I used to do long drives and I used to play these things out in my head as well, is the thing I was most scared of is getting out at the other end, or, you know, waking up the next day and going, oh my God, I've forgotten what I wrote in my head. Do you have a tape recorder or notepad or?
No, I think this is my script writing training.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the work I did at the ABC when I was working in children's television was film research, and I would have to watch a whole lot of archival research, you know, archival films, because the ABC has this extraordinary archive, and then report back to my producer on that. And what that means is that I developed a very specific kind of memory for image and dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I've written it in my head, it's like I've watched it on a movie or a TV show, and I would remember it in the same way that you would remember a really good scene from a show that you loved.
Mm. Mm.
So I might not get every word right, but I'll get the general flow right.
Wow. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute, because I just want to delve a bit deeper into The War Bride. Now, it's set in Sydney in 1920. And without giving anything away, there are scenes in the city, there are scenes in Milsons Point, in Manly, in the Camptown area. And as I was reading them and just watching these scenes unfold, they are so real. And I found myself wanting to be in Sydney at that time and explore it. Now, first, you obviously needed to do research. You said you love research. Into these specific suburbs, because there's detail in there that, as I said, makes it so real. Where did you do this research and what did it involve?
Well, for the North Sydney side of things, Lavender Bay and Berry's Bay, Stanton Library has an extraordinary local history section.
Mm-hmm.
And the librarians there were very helpful. So a lot of that was done there. The City of Sydney has an amazing photo archive. And you can find almost all sorts of streets there in the 1910s and 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just stole people's houses. So the house that Frank and Gladys live in the book is actually the house that my friend Chris lives in.
Oh.
In that particular street in Camperdown. And so I know, it's a house I know. Mm. So I just used the house that I knew. Mm. And the house that Margaret lives in, I found on Domain. It was for sale. And
wow.
So I just went looking. I went looking on Domain in that area for the kind of house that I knew would be built around the period that it had been built in the 1890s. So sometimes you've got to look sideways.
Yes.
To find what you need.
I have to confess, I have been walking around the streets of Lavender Bay trying to pick the house and trying to go, I wonder if it's that one. I wonder if it's that one. Now, it said it was this far away from this, so I wonder if it's that one.
Well, that house, that particular house is actually in Northbridge.
Ah.
Because the place where the house is in the book
is
now a modern house.
Ah, okay.
So I just put another house on that block.
Right, right, right. So how did you form your characters? Obviously you started with Margaret and that was inspired by a real person, but obviously there are other characters in the book. Did they develop also from people you knew, like some of the houses, or how were they created?
Well, Tom, who is the main love interest in the book, is a holdover character from The Soldier's Wife. And he just turned up one day. I don't know. I needed a decent man. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of tired of books where men are horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And the men in my life are decent men, and I think in most people's lives the men are pretty decent. Mm-hmm. And so I like to represent that sort of person. Mm-hmm. And he just, I don't know, he just arrived sometime. Margaret comes from West Bromwich in England, mm-hmm. and my mother-in-law comes from West Bromwich.
Right.
And so I drew on her childhood and on that of some of her friends and did a lot of research into the Black Country because, of course, it was quite different from Australia.
Mm.
So I did quite a lot of work and she helped me with that, which was fantastic. I'm very lucky in my mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
But as a character, I knew I needed somebody who had gone through a difficult war and who was reaching out to Australia as a symbol of hope and light and warmth and happiness. Mm. And so she had to be somebody who was the kind of person to reach, to look forward, not back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where she came from.
When you are, before you start writing, do you have these characters already mapped out or do they evolve as you write? And similarly, did you, like the book you're currently writing, already have your ending sorted out or did you discover the plot as you went along? How did it work for this book?
This book had a lot of backstory first. So I knew a lot of what had happened to my characters up to the point where Margaret arrived.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't quite sure how it ended. And, in fact, I cut the last 10,000 words of the book off.
Oh, wow. Was that painful?
No, actually, it was quite freeing. I realised that I'd come to an emotional climax about 10,000 words in from the end.
Right.
And although that I had done so much reading, because the last 10,000 words were about a divorce, and I had done a huge amount of research.
Mm.
And, you can't always use it. Sometimes you just have to cut it off and be ruthless. And it's no good being kind of, they were good scenes, but they didn't have the emotional impact of this earlier scene. And so I thought, no, that's actually the real climax. And so I just cut the end off. So it does evolve as you go through. The Soldier's Wife, I had no idea what was going to happen in the end, none at all. This one I knew who she'd end up with.
Right.
But I wanted the reader not to know.
Yes.
And in the one that I'm
And I didn't get now, I couldn't pick it.
Oh good.
Yeah. Mm, till that's the very
that's
end.
Really good. Yeah, that's great. Because she's put in a difficult position.
Yes.
And I don't think it's a spoiler because it's the reader knows in the first two chapters that, in fact, Frank is not married.
Mm.
was not married when he married her.
Yes, yes.
And so her marriage is in fact a legal one, even though she believes it's not. So, you know, and the other thing, of course, was the mix-up with the ships that caused that confusion. Yeah. It's a real thing. Mm-hmm. So that change from the Waimana to the border did in fact happen, exactly as it's described in the book. And it was putting those two things together, the Margaret on the ship realizing she's been, you know, conned, and this change of war brideship, putting those things together was what gave me the plot.
The $10,000 that you cut, not $10,000, 10,000 words.
Oh, I hope it's not $10,000.
10,000 words that you cut. I'm interested to know at what point in the process you cut it, because, you know, if you're cutting it from your very first draft, it is very different to when you're cutting it after you've done an incredible amount of work over the whole thing. So when was it that you chopped the end off?
Very late.
Really?
Almost the last thing we did.
Wow.
So it was at the second structural edit.
Okay.
So and
did you before that have any niggling feeling that there was something that could go?
I wasn't sure. I have to say that I wasn't sure of anything at that point. My mother had just died.
Right.
And I had no objectivity at all about anything. Sure. So I was relying on my editors, but it came from me, not from them.
Yeah.
Whereas the more I felt the book as a whole in that edit, the more I felt it tapered off at the end rather than ending strongly. Mm. And so I happened to be in at my publisher's for something else, and I went into my publisher and said, "How do you feel about me cutting 10,000 words off the end?" Okay, talk to me. but I think it's a much stronger book, and it's certainly not the most I've cut out of a book. You know, I threw 45,000 words away once.
Wow. Yeah.
And rewrote those. It was a whole storyline that had to be rewritten. But, you know, people think that redrafting is changing your sentences around, but real redrafting is that radical assessment of the story and saying, do I need it all? And what could be better?
Well, it's a very tight book, so obviously you did the right thing. You say you've got this vision, because of your background in, you know, the ABC, you've got this visual skill of really playing out the scenes like a movie in your head, or like scenes from a movie. Presumably you did that with The War Bride. Did you cast any characters, as in any actors or anything, when you play the scenes out in your head?
No, I don't. Sometimes I do with minor characters, but not in that particular book. Mm-hmm. The thing is, they're so young, these people.
Yes.
You know, like in The War Bride, Margaret's only 22.
Yeah.
And apart from anything else, her hair colour changed when they changed the cover on me. So she was originally a blonde, and then they did the cover design, and on the cover she's a brunette with green eyes instead of a blonde with blue eyes.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad in a way I didn't have a particular image of her.
Right.
Because it's more like a radio play than a film.
Yes.
In my head, you know.
Right.
And because you're looking out of your character's eyes when you're in close point of view.
Right,
and I'm looking out of Margaret's eyes. I don't see her because she doesn't see herself.
Yes, yes.
So what she looks like is less important.
Mm. Of course, I've cast the whole thing. I know who's going to star in the miniseries.
Tell me.
I won't say it here. I'll tell you later, because I don't want people to be tainted by, you know, my version of it, because it's, you know, a very personal experience when you read a book. But I will discuss my casting choices with you. Now, you're the Director of Creative Writing at the Australian Writers' Centre. So obviously this is a loaded question, but I know you well enough to know that you'll answer honestly. Yep. Do you believe that writing can be taught? And what I mean by that is, if somebody wants to write a novel, that they can, and, you know, they speak English and all of that, can they learn the skills they need to make that happen?
I believe that what we do at the centre is like what an opera coach does. Mm-hmm. We can't give someone a voice but if they want to sing, we can help them improve their voice. So I do believe that a lot of writing is technique. A lot of the times when people come to me and they say, I've got this problem and I never finish anything, or I can't get past this point, or I know my dialogue's no good, that can all be fixed. Mm. You know, the thing you can't give someone is the desire to sing, which is the desire to tell the story.
Yep.
So it's my belief that if you have the desire to tell the story, we can help you tell it better than you would otherwise do. And some people will take that on and do the work, because that's the other ingredient. You know, like the opera singer, you have to do your scales. You have to practice. You have to do the writing. You have to sit down and actually type the words. Mm. And the number one reason that your book won't be published is that you haven't written it.
Yes, so true.
And so I think if you've got someone who has the voice, that is the desire to tell the story, we can help them do that.
So apart from not having written the book, what else do you see most aspiring writers struggle with? And how do they overcome that, you know, common struggle?
Okay, I think there are two main issues, mm-hmm. and they're almost at opposite ends, funnily enough. One is the desire to have everything perfect on a first draft. And so people keep going back over and over the early chapters. Mm. But that's not what a first draft is for. A first draft is to find out what your book's about. And you can't get the beginning perfect until you know what the end is. Because as a writer, you need to seed ideas through your book that will come to fruition in the climax. Mm. And unless you know what the climax is, and most people don't know what the climax is when they start writing the beginning, mm. then you can't possibly get the beginning right. And so people are trying to do something that's literally impossible. And what I say to them is, promise yourself that you will do 100 drafts if that's what it takes to get it perfect. Mm. Trust yourself that you'll do that, but just keep writing and get to the end of your first draft, and then you can start working on perfecting it. Mm. The other problem is that people aren't prepared to do the work.
Yes.
You know, they write one draft and they think it's finished, and they like copy edit it, you know, and they fix up their commas, yeah. and they think it's done. Mm-hmm. But that's not true, mm. you know. And when I know a lot of editors and publishers, obviously, mm. and what they say to me is the single most common mistake people make is sending the book in too early.
Mm. What do you think, in terms of the War Bride, back to the War Bride, was the most enjoyable part of that whole process or experience, or, you know, whichever part was best for you?
I love the hairstyles.
The hairstyles?
Because this is...
Seriously?
I just loved it. I did a lot of research about hairstyles, because in the process of the book she gets a haircut, because that's when bobs were coming in.
Yes.
That's when women were getting rid of their long hair. Yes. So that was lots of fun. And also the whole surf stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So Margaret has never swum before, mm. and she's, you know, inducted into surfing, mm. as surf shooting, as it was called then, which is body surfing, mm. In the course of the book, and it becomes very important to her. And probably one of the hardest scenes to write, mm-hmm. was the scene she first goes into the surf. Mm-hmm. Because if, like most Australians, you've been swimming before you can remember, yeah. Trying to write how it feels to go into the surf for the very first time, that was a real imaginative exercise for me. Trying to figure out how she would feel about it,
yeah.
not how I would feel as someone who's comfortable with water and knows she can swim,
yeah.
but how she would feel about it as someone who'd literally never got wet except in a bath or a shower before.
Mm-mm. And also how she would feel, you know, wearing whatever it was that they wore in those days.
Well, that's a big issue too, of course, and there was a lot of research went into the kinds of suits that people wore, and Australian women were very in the forefront of swimming costume redesign to make it safe. Because most of the women's costumes at that period were very dangerous, mm. because they were so heavy. They were made of wool, a lot of them, and with skirts and, you know, sleeves and caps, and a lot of women drowned, particularly in England. Mm. and America. And so Australian women, they were in the forefront of getting the one-piece sewing costumes. And the funny thing is that in the 1920s, it's the only time in history that women and men have basically worn exactly the same thing in the surf. So they both had the singlet tops and the kind of thigh-length shorts that all in one piece, much like, funnily enough, much like the Olympic swimmers were now.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Now, you obviously do love research. Why do you love it so much? What do you, you know, what is it?
Well, I don't know. I just think it's fascinating. There's so many interesting bits. And quite often you'll find something and it will lead you onto something you didn't expect.
Yes.
And certainly the life-saving stuff in this book, I didn't know there were two surf clubs in Manly. One was the Manly Life Saving Club and the other was the surf club. And that goes back to 1905. There was a difference between the people who wanted to just surf and the people who wanted to save people.
Mm.
You know? And things like that. The Life Saving Club let me have access to their records, their archives, and that was just fascinating.
Yeah, I bet. Now, your research for The Soldier's Wife led you to this novel.
Yes.
You're already planning your next one, obviously. Has the research for this led you to your next book?
Yes. Yes, it has.
Can you give some hints?
I can tell you about it.
Great.
It's fine. It's called A Letter from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about one of the first women war correspondents. So she's not a real character, but she's inspired by a real character, Louisa Mack, mm-hmm. who was one of the first women in the world to be a war correspondent. She was Australian,
mm-hmm.
and she reported from Belgium on the invasion of Belgium by Germany and, went behind enemy lines and all sorts of stuff and wrote a book about it and then came back here. And the reason I got onto her was because when I was doing the research for The Soldier's Wife and The War Bride, I kept reading the women's pages of The Herald and The Age.
Oh.
And there was this woman writing, no byline or anything, but this woman writing for them who was incredibly feminist, like unbelievable, the sort of thing you could pick up and put straight down in a contemporary newspaper, which is kind of sad, really, you know, that's still fighting the same things. Mm. But she was so modern, and that turned out to be Louisa Mack when I did a bit more research. And so I thought, well, that's really very interesting. And when my publisher suggested that we go more international for the next book, that was a kind of no-brainer to say, let's have a war correspondent. And we've gone to Italy because the Australian Navy was in Italy.
Right.
And this is a part of World War One nobody knows about. So they were helping blockade the Adriatic Sea against Lieutenant von Trapp in a submarine.
Mm-hmm.
So the Sound of Music guy was on the other side. He was on the Austro-Hungarian side as the submarine commander.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So the Australians were working with the Italians to blockade the Adriatic because a lot of the major Austrian ports were on the Adriatic.
And how far into it are you?
I'm only about 10,000 words into it, but I've done most of the research.
Yeah, right.
And the Navy has been fantastic,
yeah.
Just fantastic. Yeah.
Wow, I can't wait to read that already. So is this a book that you'll be fitting in with life, or have you got a timeline, a delivery date, all that sort of thing?
No, normally I'm asked to deliver in August,
mm-hmm.
And that means that I have to really put my head down now, and I'll be aiming for 10,000 words a week.
Oh, my God.
That's okay. That's for somebody who's doing it more or less full time. That's not too bad at all. 2,000 words a day, 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And sometimes you do more and sometimes you do less, but it averages out about that.
Mm.
But now I feel like now I've imagined the ending. Now I can really dive into it and get right stuck into it.
Mm.
And, again.
Now, you mentor many people who are writing their novels. You run our six-month novel writing program and you see entire manuscripts. What's your advice for aspiring writers who hope to be in a position like you are one day and have their 29th book come out? Okay, maybe don't cast that far ahead. Maybe to get their first book out.
I think the first thing is you have to give it priority. Mm-hmm. There's always a reason not to write. People are very busy and, you know, people are working or they have a family and there's always demands on your time. And writing, and I think this is particularly true for women, writing can seem like a selfish thing to do. And you just have to decide, well, okay, if that's selfish, I'm going to be selfish. And, you know, you can always vacuum tomorrow. Or you can cut out a TV show. If you've got time to write, if you've got time to watch two television shows regularly every week, you've got time to write a novel. But you have to say, this is important to me. And I think that's what, it's a big statement to make, to say this is important enough for me to guarantee that much time a week, because that sets you up for failing. And I think people are afraid that, oh, well, if I do write the novel and it's no good, then I've wasted all that time. And I would say, no, you haven't. Any more than a garage band has wasted time playing in the garage, or a amateur photographer has wasted time taking photographs. It's worth doing just for the love of it, even if you don't get published. And very few first novels get published. You've got to learn on your first book usually. So just because your first book doesn't get up there, that doesn't mean your second or your third won't. And none of it's wasted. None of it, that time is wasted.
Wonderful advice. And on that note, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much, Val.
There you go, Pamela Freeman / Pamela Hart.
Well, it's a fantastic interview, and it's always great to hear from Pamela, because we have I've interviewed her before, but she has such an enormous wealth of knowledge that, you know, I could talk to her daily and you would always be learning something new and different. She's very, very clever.
Absolutely right. I learn something pretty much every time I speak to Pamela. So let's move on to our working writer's tip this week. This question comes from Bettina. Now, if you do have a question you'd like us to answer on the podcast, do email us, podcast@writerscentre.com.au. So Bettina has asked, I'm finalising my memoir manuscript and have made lists of publishers and agents to pitch it to. Some of the big publishers do not accept unsolicited manuscripts. Some agents do not read your submission if the manuscript has been submitted to any other agent or publisher. Where to start? I have not been published by a traditional publisher before, but self-published a book in 2014. Should I rather contact agents first and see what they say before submitting directly to a publisher? How would an agent react if I had several rejections from publishers before I contacted them? Thanks for your advice. Over to you, Al.
I love it when you do this. You know what? One of these days I'm going to read out the question and then I'm just going to throw it at you. Okay, so my first thoughts on this are, if you want an agent, you go to agents first. You don't submit your publisher, don't submit your manuscript to a whole range of publishers and then decide that you want to get an agent for it. You get one shot with a manuscript. And so you need to make sure that if you want an agent to do that for you, then you need to get your agent lined up first. That would be my my first thought on it. As far as agents not reading manuscripts that have been submitted to any other agent or publisher, agents like to know that they have the manuscript exclusively at that particular time. If you're going to submit to several agents at once, you need to let them know that you've done that. And some agents don't like that. So you either need to be patient and just do one at a time and wait to see. Like, personally, I would choose my absolute first number one choice and go with them first and only. Wait to see what happens with that. And yes, it takes time, but you know what? I have to tell you this, and this is going to be my number one tip for writers for all time. Everything in publishing takes a long time. And the sooner you get used to waiting for stuff to happen, the better, because it never gets any better. I'm telling you, it never gets any better. It takes forever. So patience is one of the things that you need to start and I wish I'd learned this myself 10 years ago, I would have saved myself so much angst, and Valerie. I would have saved Valerie so much angst as well, because she has to listen to me whinge. But really, learn that the patience is really, really important. So I would choose my number one choice and I would send it to them, and I would wait to see what happened from that point, and then go, you know, through your list that way if you want to go with an agent. If you want to go with a publisher, you know, it's a very similar process. Choose your number one, you know, publisher that you want to go with. It, some of them will accept a manuscript if it's been submitted to multiple, you know, publishers, but they ask that you let them know, because it just allows, you know, it's that whole thing of like, well, do I need to read this quickly or not? It's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you go to the guidelines on the agent's page and on the publisher's page and you follow those. But yeah, if you want an agent, go the agents first.
Yeah.
And would that be your advice?
Yeah, definitely. And also in the terms of the question, how would an agent react if I had several rejections from publishers before I contacted them? Well, my answer to that is an agent would first say, well, have you revised your manuscript if it's been rejected so many times?
Yeah.
If you haven't, then how do you think they're going to react?
Yeah.
You know, if you haven't bothered to revise it, if you've had all of these rejections, and if you haven't tried to figure out, well, what exactly, what isn't right with it, and tried to revise it, then an agent's not going to think that great. But if you have revised it, and, you know, especially if you've revised it significantly, I don't see why an agent would have a problem with it, because the fact is it's actually a different manuscript now.
That's right. You might want to give it a different title so the publishers don't immediately recognise it if it comes back to them.
Yeah.
And I also reckon that you should probably do Natasha Lester's course on how to pitch to agents and publishers, because it's a fabulous on-demand course. And, you know, we get so much great feedback about it on Twitter. I, you know, as running the social media accounts as I do, you know, I'm constantly saying, oh, my God, I did this course. It was fantastic, you know. And Natasha Lester really knows what she's talking about. So it might be worth, you know, doing that before you send your manuscript out.
Absolutely. We'll put that link in the show notes as well. But again, if you're walking the dog and having a look at the Writer Center website, it's called How to Pitch to Agents and Publishers. All right. So we are almost at the end of this week's episode. What are you up to this week, Al?
Well, hilariously, and people who know me well will find this very amusing, I'm trying to outline a couple of books that I haven't written yet.
Oh, so, they're in your head?
I'm attempting to make some kind of a plan for a couple of books that I need to write, and I'm just so bad at it. Like, I've got stuff like, this happens, and then XXXX, maybe something else happens, but I'm not sure what yet, but then this will happen, and then there'll be – yeah, no, I'm no good at it. This is why I have to write books to find out what's going to happen in them, but it's a very long-winded way of going about it.
Oh, my goodness. So do you think you will be able to be successful in outlining it?
Well, put it this way. The only thing that is saving me is that I have known from the start of writing these books that I know how it's going to end. So I know where the ending is, and I know a couple of key plot points along the way. This is all I have. So it's a matter of if I can just maybe put those bits in and then hope for the best. I don't know. Look, it's, and the other thing is, I know that as soon as I start actually writing the thing, it will change, because something will happen and it'll be like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. So yeah, I don't know. But you know, it's one of those things that you have to do. So I'm trying to learn. I probably should go and do Kate Forsyth's plotting workshop and just be done with it, really. But anyway, so that's what I'm doing. It's very amusing for everyone else, but not for me.
And it sounds like fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What about you? What will you be doing?
What will I be doing? I have, I am launching Pamela Freeman's, Pamela Hart's latest book, The War Bride.
Have you written your speech?
I haven't yet, but I shall. So that's going to be very exciting. I'm doing another full day of How to Build Your Profile workshops in Sydney, so no doubt I will be exhausted and my feet will hurt at the end of the day again. But and then I'm going to have a bit of a relax on the weekend, you know.
Well, relaxing's just good.
Yeah, just to just to watch some TV or something after a very busy week. So there you go. Where do we find you online, Al?
You'll find me at alisontate.com. You'll find me on Twitter at @AlTate, You'll find me on Facebook at Alison Tate Writer, and you'll find me on Instagram also at Alison Tate Writer.
Yes, do reach out to us on social media. We'd love to hear from you and let us know what you think about the podcast. Also, if anyone has a 30 seconds to leave us a review or rating on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it because that helps us in the rankings. You'll find me at Valerie Koo on Twitter and Instagram. Just search for Valerie Koo on Facebook and look for my picture. I'm also on Snapchat from time to time as The Valerie Koo.
She'll be fomenting over there if anyone
I will
wants
be
her.
Fomenting, yes, over there. And, of course, you can find the show notes at soyouwanttobeawriter.com.au. So that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening, everyone, and we look forward to chatting to you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. You'll find the show notes at writerscentre.com.au/podcast or sign up for our awesome and often hilarious weekly newsletter at writerscentre.com.au/news, where you'll find writing resources, giveaways, competitions, and much more.